You're listening to the Podcast Network. Over 4 million steaming hot podcasts served since 2005. As the ladies from En Vogue said, free your mind, and the rest will follow.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. So said Gordon Gekko in Oliver Stone's best film, 1987's Wall Street, a film, funnily enough, where Gekko was supposed to be portrayed as being evil, but they reckon that movie was the most effective recruitment tool for the investment banking industry ever. Welcome to G'day World 200 and something. I think it's 202, might be 203. I can't even remember. My special guest today, freelance journalist and editor to the stars, Andrew Pegler, going to talk to us about private equity firms. Andy?
G'day, Cameron. How are you?
Good, Peggers. What do you know?
Well, I love being a freelance journalist to the stars because, as you know, I'm a big fan of black holes. Let's kick off with some gags.
Now, welcome to the show, mate. First time you've been on this show.
It has. It's an honour because, of course, I have been following your career through the media for some time now.
Well, it's funny we should be doing Gordon Gekko because I am the Gordon Gekko of podcasting.
That's what I thought.
And now, some people may know that you and I have done a couple of podcasts before. We did a little thing on real estate.
.com.
Yes.
.au.
Yes.
Yeah, we did some corporate. We've done a bit of corporate podcasting, but I think both of us have dipped our toes in the art and corporate world enough.
Dipped ourselves in the what? Art, did you say?
Art and corporate.
Oh, art. Yeah,
yes,
right.
Sorry, yes. The art and corporate world enough to, I guess,
know nothing at all about private equity firms. But
yeah.
So tell people a bit about yourself. You're a writer.
Yeah, I'm a Melbourne-based freelance writer. I've written two books, one of which was called John Howard's Little Book of Truths, and the other one was The Bugle's Dick Shinery, which was a dictionary of Australian profanity. And I've been a freelance journalist to all sorts of magazines and newspapers around Australia for 15 or so years. And I do a lot these days of corporate finance writing.
Whoring yourself out, really.
Oh, absolutely. I'll bend over and take it from anyone who'll pay, as you know.
Wait, what do you mean, as you know? You're suggesting that I've paid to take you up the bumhole?
No, let's
not get that rumour out there.
Okay, sure.
You're the editor of Monash Business Review, a very fine publication.
It is, and I'm the editor of Monash Business Review, which is a sort of Monash's Harvard Business Review. Basically, what we do is we take academic papers in the business area and I repurpose them to be sort of sexy magazine articles. So it's like taking a lump of clay and moulding it into something much more attractive. So the idea and the concept is there, but most academics are not brilliant writers. They're quite dense in the way they write. And I come through and give it a bit of a magazine touch and feel, and we keep the essential message.
You sex it up like...
I do.
Like a few reports on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were sexed up. Particularly in the United Kingdom.
We sexed all of those up at Monash Business Review.
So tell me why you've been researching private equity firms.
Well, it's just something that just took my interest. I don't really know why. I'm always interested in things that are new and things that are changing paradigms. And private equity is one of those things that's being ushered in at the moment. And maybe I can give you a tiny bit of background. Essentially, what is private equity is probably a good question we should look at. Basically, private equity is an equity investment in an asset, and the equity that is used to buy that asset is
Hello.
And essentially what they'll do is...
Hold on a second there, mate.
...control the management of the company.
Andrew?
Yep.
Yeah, you just dropped out for about 10 seconds there, mate. Can you just go back to describing what a private equity firm is?
Essentially, private equity is an investment in an asset using private money. So it's not using money raised through a public company. So essentially, you've got a bunch of guys that come together and either they own this money or someone has lent it to them to invest. So essentially, it's private money. And they come along to a public company or a startup like the podcast network, and they will offer this money to buy the company out. In the case of a public company, they'll offer it shareholders, for example, with Qantas. I think they're offering $3.60 a share, which is something like 20-25% above the value or something along those lines. The shareholders think, well, you know, I'm going to make 20% of my money. It's going to take me 5 years to do that. Why don't I just sell now to these guys? They come in to a public company, buy all these shares up, and then they assume management of it. So it no longer, the company no longer has the encumbrance of being a public company. So it doesn't have sort of an onerous continuous disclosure regime. It doesn't have to put an annual report out. It doesn't have to put out quarterly reports. It doesn't also involve the same exposure to liability for the directors as what a public company does. So I was kind of interested in seeing all of these public companies suddenly fall into private hands, and there was this sort of paradigm shift going on where the public company, which was once the pinnacle, I guess, of corporate achievement, and to be a public company CEO was an extraordinarily prestigious appointment. It was starting to become a bit to be overrun by the private equity movement, and I was interested in what effectively is the death of the public company in a lot of ways. And so I have been exploring this idea through Monash Business Review and also a magazine called Anthill, which is an Australian business magazine. I happened to be at a Christmas party with the editor and publisher. We just started talking about stuff over many beers, and we ended up parting company with me writing the cover story on the death of the public company. So that's kind of a summary of why I got into it.
So that's coming out, is it, in a upcoming issue, or is it in the current issue? What's the deal?
That's coming up in the maybe April issue, I think.
Okay.
I have to check on that. Yeah, so that's how that one's going to run.
Let's just talk about some of the implications of private equity. Now, there's obviously, from an Australian perspective, there's been a few of these happen in the last 12 months. We saw Coles Myer being taken over by Blackstone and Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, KKR.
Yeah, absolutely, the KKR.
Hey, funnily enough, a very good friend of mine in San Francisco knows Henry Kravis, actually babysat for him. He was telling me when I was over there late last year, he said, when I was in university, I paid my way by, babysitting Henry Kravis's kids for 4 years.
He'd be well paid.
He was, but the friendship has continued, and so he was actually we were trying to hook up and have dinner with Henry Kravis while I was over there, but I think Henry was in London or something at the time.
Well, that'd be nice. Henry could, the scraps off his table would fund the podcast network for about the next 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we've got, they bought out Coles Myer, and then we've obviously got a consortium at the moment headed by Macquarie Bank that's looking at taking over Qantas.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
What are some of the others? We've had some of the big media companies as well go into play.
Yeah, Channel 9 and Channel 7 have fallen into private hands. Probably, though, the for me, one of the more talkaboutable stories is that of Pacific Brands. They was Pacific, what was it, Pat Dunlop and hang on, I'm just trying to remember now what the name of it. Pacific Brands had two companies anyway, and Pacific Brands, as you may know, have all sorts of other companies, but they floated, they sold off these two companies to private equity, and private equity then took that management role for 2 or 3 years and then relisted these companies. So what happens is they bought all the shares in them, then they for 3 years ran the company in a very lean, mean, fighting machine kind of way, took it back to the market and relisted it, and everyone who invested in it made 5 times their money. So that's kind of the model, the ideal model of private equity. And certainly the Qantas deal, that's the biggest private equity play in this country's history, and it's an $11 billion play. And it's an interesting one because some people sort of wonder why they're doing it, because it's not like there's anything really wrong with Qantas. So the margins for what they might make when they flip it, which is when they either sell it off to another private investor or take it back to market, aren't going to be as great as a struggling company, which they would turn around, which is what really good private equity does.
Now, I started off the show slightly facetiously with a famous quote from Gordon Gekko from Wall Street, played by Michael Douglas, obviously. And yes. It's funny, my mates and I actually grew up watching that film. I mean, that was kind of our Bible. I've still got a good mate of mine who is an investment banker, and 99% of the times he'll call me, he'll open the phone call with, "Money don't sleep, pal," which is Charlie Sheen, Bud Fox comment in that. But Gordon Gekko was based on, a bunch of characters that ran around in the 80s that were financing acquisitions through mostly junk bond finance, thanks to Michael Milken. And Drexel Burnham Lambert, the big firm that kind of pioneered junk bond financing in the late 70s into the 80s. And guys like Carly Khan and Ivan Boesky, who infamously made a lot of money at a junk bond financed acquisition, slash and burn acquirers. And, obviously, for people who haven't seen Wall Street, Gekko plays this guy who's an incredibly rich New York investment banker who does exactly what you're saying, goes and buys companies that he feels are underperforming. And, in fact, the first part of the Greed is Good speech sums it up quite nicely. He says he's at a shareholders meeting of a company where he's taken a significant stake. He's sort of, what do they call an aggressive takeover? I can't remember the terminology for it.
Well, it's pretty much just an aggressive, an aggressive bid, I guess. An aggressive takeover is the way I describe that.
Yeah, they used to have terminology for it in the 80s. I can't remember what it was called, but he says to the shareholders in the meeting, a typical annual general meeting, he says to them, "You own the company. That's right, you the stockholder, and you're all being royally screwed over by these bureaucrats with their luncheons, their hunting and fishing trips, their corporate jets, their golden parachutes. Teldar Paper," which was the name of the company he was taking over, "has 33 different vice presidents, each earning over $200,000 a year. Now, I've spent the last 2 months analysing what all these guys do, and I still can't figure it out. One thing I do know is that our paper company lost $110 million last year, and I'll bet that half of that was spent in all the paperwork going back and forth between all these vice presidents." And he declares himself not a destroyer of companies, but a liberator of them. So that was the way the character saw himself, and a lot of these guys saw themselves taking underperforming companies that have got underperforming assets, stripping out a lot of the dead wood and bureaucracy, making them lean and mean and profitable, and then selling off a lot of divisions and sacking a lot of employees when they do that. Now, this is where PE firms are getting themselves into a bit of public hot water at the moment around the world, aren't they? It's not just happening in Australia, it's happening in the US and the UK, where unions and governments are starting to get concerned as to what it means for jobs.
Yeah. Well, there's a downside to private equity, and that is, as you've mentioned, the shop floor guy that loses his job, and the accountant that's been there for 20 years that loses his job, so on and so forth. And also, one other downside, I think, depending on the company, but if it's a major public utility like an airline or even a telephone company, these are arguably public assets as well. So when they go into private hands, they escape the sort of scrutiny that such important pillars of the economy should actually have. So yeah, it's not all great news with private equity. I mean, it's an efficient, I mean, I guess it's the law of the jungle type of thing, but even in the jungle there has to be a bit of friendliness. But no, I mean, and also there's not a lot, when you think about what was going on in the 80s and what's going on now, there's an element of history repeating itself, because at the moment, like in the 80s, private equity is in the midst of effectively a perfect storm for its development, I guess. The combination of the world being is awash with money after, the madness, the run on the equity markets over the last 5 years has been amazing. So there's a lot of people out there with a lot of dough, and they need to put it somewhere. And then they're looking around, and the public company increasingly is becoming sort of trapped by its short-termism. And as I said, those disclosure regulations that came about, with the collapse of HIH, OneTel, WorldCom and Enron. And along with a few other changes, like there's the federal government recently introduced some tax changes that exempt foreign investment from paying capital gains on anything not involving property. And basically, the smouldering pyre, I guess, of the PLC or the public listed company is starting to fire up. The variables are there to really give the publicly listed company a real shakeout.
Now, there's also been some suggestions. I read a report from Europe that suggested that they did a survey of something like more than 30,000 companies in Europe and the US, and found that companies owned by PE firms compared to companies not funded by PE capital, so companies traditionally in the public markets, actually, yep, the PE owned companies create a lot more jobs, or have in the last 4 years, than those in the public market. So I guess it's not exactly clear whether or not they are the danger to job growth that they are sometimes portrayed as being by the unions.
No, that's a really good point. I guess the jobs that are more wasteful go, and the jobs that are more useful get filled. So it's really, in a way, there is a certain amount of employment that will result, but a lot of it is also just shifting the workforce into more productive methods. I mean, the actual Australian PE market or sector, I guess, provides jobs just through private equity firms themselves, and private equity investments creates jobs for up to 8% of total Australian workforce. So it's actually having it's having a pretty significant effect, and pretty positive effect.
So what should the audience know about PE firms? What are the things that, for the punter, we need to be aware of or concerned about over the next few years as we watch this happen?
Well, I guess you've really got to look to see that the private equity firm is conducting itself with some aspect of due diligence in relation to morality. And other sort of corporate personality traits. So they also, you'll find that most PE firms that come into a public company bring in with it quite a modern and fresh outlook in terms of sustainability and environmental issues and stuff like that. So it's actually ushering in quite a lot of good developments in that area. But the fear, of course, always is that the private equity company comes in and, without any concern for the existing employees, will sort of cut a swathe through, and a lot of people will, you know, at least initially end up, you know, unemployed. But in terms of what to look out for, I just think, you know, sit back and watch it and just be, you know, amazed at this sort of amount of money that is just sloshing around. And, you know, private equity in Australia has claimed all sorts of companies, which you probably, you know, most people probably don't even know of. For example, you know, JB Hi-Fi, Godfrey's Vacuum Cleaners, Kathmandu Clothing, you know, and the Just Group, you know, the Just Jeans people. They're just a couple of companies. And I reckon that USB Bank reckon that private equity could take about $33 billion of shares off the Australian market this year. So in other words, private equity will come along and buy $33 billion of shares off the Australian market, which is a huge amount.
I wonder if that means, though, that if there are less companies on the ASX, that there's more opportunities for new companies to get funded in IPOs. So, I mean, I guess the punters, if they're all being bought out of their shareholding profitably from existing publicly listed assets, they've got more money which they need to reinvest. The property market's still going strongly in Australia, but I guess there's some concerns that it, you know, might be peaking. So they're going to be putting their money into, still wanting to put their money back into shares, that percentage of their portfolio. So it means there's perhaps more money to go around for new companies that want to get funded that aren't big enough or for whatever reason can't attract private equity. They're able to, you know, they might stand a better chance raising public equity. Do you see that as one of the spin-outs?
No, not necessarily. I think that what will happen is actually smaller companies will have more chance of getting funding because private equity funds will be looking at investing, because they particularly like kind of venture capital type investments. So I don't necessarily think that it's going to open up more opportunities for, you know, wannabe publicly listed companies. I think that the capital, that IPO, the sort of money sloshing around in private equity will exceed that. So I think that, if anything, private equity will create more opportunities for companies that choose not to list. Because listing is, essentially, it's a painful process. There's so much
and getting
to go through.
Getting more painful all the time, right, with Sarbanes-Oxley and as a result of Enron and WorldCom and OneTel and a lot of the high-profile cases of corporate malfeasance and corruption over the last 5 or 6 years.
That was a Francais there.
It was English with a, you know, bullshit faux Francais accent, yeah.
Yeah, well, I fell for it. Absolutely. Yeah, that corporate culture from about 2000 to 2001, where those companies, as you mentioned, all got into the dirt, really changed the way the public listed company had to conduct itself. And so due diligence and governance and those sort of things are quite onerous these days. And, you know, to the point where the average CEO of a major listed Australian company will spend a quarter of his day looking into external communications issues or talking to analysts or dealing with press, stuff like that. Whereas before they didn't have to do quite that much, but yeah, now they do. So it's changed.
Yeah, it's, you know, I got a mate of mine here in Melbourne who runs a publicly listed company, you know, sort of medium-sized, been around for a few years, and he and I were talking late last year about whether or not we should float TPN on the stock exchange, and he was saying, well, you know, I've got the investment banking connections, I can make it happen for you, there's definitely a lot of money out there, there'd be an appetite for it, but, you know, he said to me, the question you need to ask yourself is, do you want to be the CEO of a publicly listed company? And he was saying, you know, what a huge amount of work and pressure it is, just that always having 1,000 different people looking over your shoulder, regulatory-wise.
Yeah. Well, it's like it's a fishbowl existence. So everything you say is seen and recorded. And then you say something, you can't be off the cuff about something because it'll affect your share price. And that, I mean, that's the other thing about being a public listed company is you're so prostrate to data that comes out. Or for example, I spoke to Peter Yates recently, who's one of the guys heading part of the consortium that's buying Qantas, and he used to run Channel 9, and he was saying that they'd have a bad ratings day on Friday and the shares would open down on Monday, even though the ratings themselves don't actually affect the core business. The advertising rates stay the same and they will be the same for 12 months. I mean, no, there's no real effect on it. But the point is, a public company is very vulnerable to data, and a private equity company doesn't have that sort of hassle, so that it's a much, they can just do and say and be and pretty much how they want to do and be and say, and it's as long as the, you know, their actions are aimed towards improving the viability of the company.
Mm. But the flip side is, I mean, the daily share price of a company doesn't really affect its operations unless it's trying to raise more capital in that particular day of the week. I mean,
No, not really. But I guess you've got to think a ailing share price will send financial journalists into a frenzy, you know, like a cackling hyena's over a fetid zebra corpse. And they'll start writing things that might not particularly favourable about your company, and I guess that has a sort of a trickle down or knock on effect through the community, and people start to see the company is maybe not as hot as it was. And having a good share price is good for the company for all sorts of reasons. It's like having a very nice front door.
Well, speaking as a former employee of companies where I had share options that didn't perform very well,
right?
You know, it's certainly a mechanism for employee incentivization that can go well or not so well. I can tell you, mood and climate at Microsoft in the late 90s was a lot stronger in terms of employee satisfaction than it is today.
Yeah, really.
Well, the share price was booming back in the late 90s and everyone was making money. You know, employees who had share options, and everyone did, was making money hand over fist. So you could look past some of the other challenges working there with the fact that you were building a nice little asset portfolio. But the share...
Yeah, I think that whole idea of employees having equity is a fantastic concept. It's relatively new. I mean, in the history of business, it's like, I guess for mainstream companies, it's a 20 to 25 years it's been around, but it really, you know, and I guess it is very much in the US ethos of, you know, you get what you deserve, so you give people a chance to own part of the company, and then they're that much fired up to work for you, and it works itself really well, you know, in terms of efficiency. I remember, I don't know, have you heard of company called ComputerShare?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote their annual report in 2000, and I was in the office, and there was a couple of secretaries that had been there since the beginning, and, you know, they were just given a couple of shares, obviously a chunk of shares at, you know, whatever it was, 5 cents or something, and, you know, those shares were $7 or $8 or something at that stage, and they just made a fortune, and they were just, you know, secretaries that have been around since the beginning. So there are advantages of doing that, and also it helps which company you work for. A company like ComputerShare was just onto a good thing early, and you know, that's how that one works.
Yeah, I know people at Microsoft who have exactly the same story, mate. There's one lass in particular at Microsoft in Melbourne who's been with the company, I think, now for 20 years, give or take, and started off as a first job out of school and is now worth a bucket load of money. But, of course, employee stock options in the US have pretty much been wiped out over the last couple of years, as a result of a lot of the finance recognition systems that were put into place as a result of the Enron collapse, etc. I know Microsoft has sort of wiped out employee stock options. Now you get stock, you don't get stock options anymore, because it's easier for them to calculate the value and the exposure of that to the company than it is to figure out the future exposure of a bunch of employee stock options. So even that has sort of gone away.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, well, you know, the thing about financial, or anything in financial markets or anything to do with corporate culture, it is ever evolving, and it just needs to react to the times. Otherwise, it gets left behind. So, I mean, you can see that in the fact that corporate social responsibility and sustainability and green issues and stuff like that are now, you know, up there with leading issues that the companies want to put forward as representing their culture. Whereas, mate, even 3 years ago, the green thing was a bit, you know, oh, that's just a bunch of loonies chasing whales around Antarctica, isn't it? But now it's, you know, if you've got green credentials, it can bump your share price up. So they're running around doing what they can. I know ANZ are pretty active in that area at the moment. They just put out a booklet outlining their corporate social responsibility doctrine, and, you know, it's all there.
They cut down some trees to make a booklet to talk about their environmental ethics.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And they made sure that they were extremely rare trees. Actually, they made them out of bonsai, the whole lot of them.
So that's private equity firms. What else has been on your mind lately, mate? I know that you're also a part-time music journalist. You covered anyone interesting lately? Who was the last band you did a story on?
Well, the last gig that I reviewed was the Rolling Stones at the Rod Laver Arena, and that was absolutely amazing. They were just, the boys were just rocking and rolling.
The boys, the very old
the
men,
lads.
You mean?
The lads, oh, look, they're the boys to me. You know that. I just couldn't believe it when Keith Richards just stepped out of the stage, and I can't remember which song he opened on, but I mean, I was actually literally in shock for 10 minutes because I couldn't believe that this wasn't a live album, and I wasn't in a living room somewhere with a beer, you know, talking madly about how good this music is. I was actually live, and it was, you know, it was there, and that was an amazing gig. That was a really amazing gig. They've still got it. They've still got it, those guys.
And you spent some time with some ladies of the night recently?
Remind me of that one.
Oh, sorry, that wasn't professional. That was just for personal interest.
I think you might have been talking. I recently did a story on feminism in Australia, and I interviewed one of the leading porn stars in the country.
Oh, that's right, porn stars, yes.
Yasmin Taylor, her name was, and we chatted, you know, widely on various issues, as I'm sure you can imagine, mainly to do with porking, essentially.
Yasmin have any useful tips for you on the nature of the act of the pork?
No, not really. I was quite surprised that she used to watch porn with her parents. That was the thing that I took from the interview, amongst other things.
Before or after she got involved in the industry?
I think before.
Right, right.
Yes, she grew up with porn being a bit of a family entertainment.
So she said, the mummy and daddy said, Yasmin, what do you want to do when you grow up? And she said, well, I'd like to be a porn star. And like any good parents, they said, great, well, we'll sort of invest in some educational material for you and guide you in your career decision.
Yeah, we'll get some, you know, Baby Einstein porn videos out for you, and sit you down, and you can just see how it all works, darling. I know she was very nice, and that was an interesting piece. Feminism, the whole idea of the modern feminist.
Did you tell your missus you were catching up with the porn star?
I did actually. She wasn't too unhappy about it. I think she's reasonably. She knows what I'm like. I do these sort of things. She's used to it, I guess. But, you know, that was a great piece, and I'm just putting to bed the next issue of Monash Business Review, and we're focusing mainly on something called Islamic banking, which, you know, in a very, very brief way, essentially is banking without any interest, because, as you know, in the Quran, you're not allowed to pay or receive interest.
Oh, I didn't realise that. It's considered usury, is it?
It is. Usury, yes. Or jewry, I think, is the other term for it. And so, they've worked out all these ways to get around it, so they can still have a banking system. But they do things like for a home loan, instead of you actually getting the money off the bank and then buying the home and then paying the bank your interest, the bank will buy the home for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
At an inflated price, and sell it to you at an inflated price, and you will pay back installments that don't contain interest.
Mm.
So it's just really essentially just playing with definitions. That's how they get around it. But that's a really interesting area, Islamic banking, and it's going off at the moment.
Really?
Yeah.
Do they loan money to people of non-Islamic persuasion?
They do, but they will not lend money for any purpose that they see as anti...
As immoral.
As immoral, yeah. So gambling, prostitution, all of that sort of stuff, or very risky deals is actually against the Quran to go in the high-risk deals as well.
I wonder if podcasting is considered immoral.
Only if you're doing it, from what I can tell.
I try my best.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a bit of fun. That's interesting. And then the next issue of Monash Business Review, I want to sort of focus a bit more on climate change and how that's going to affect business. So I'm just searching around now for papers and submissions along those lines.
I should introduce you to my new friend Peter Elliard, who will be on the show tomorrow.
Why is that name familiar?
Probably because I was talking to you about him over breakfast the other day.
Yeah, right. I thought he might have been in the media or something.
No, quite possibly. He's Australia's best loved futurist and he's got a new book coming out on sustainability, among other things. The Rise of Planetism, I think the book is going to be called.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like those bold books with those rise of whatever it is. The rise of anything, I'll read it.
Well, his last book was called Ideas for the New Millennium, which came out in 99, 2000, I think.
Right.
And you were also the guy who late last year took me to see Little Miss Sunshine.
I did. Well, it was a good film, I thought.
I was a little bit concerned as to aspersions about our sexuality when you suggested a group of dads go along for a movie night and we ended up seeing Little Miss Sunshine, but it was a great film. And I'll tell you what I saw today was The Queen. Have you seen The Queen?
I have, actually. I thought that was a great film.
I enjoyed it. I'm going to do a lengthy review about it tonight. You're welcome to join me if you've got nothing else on.
I'll keep that in mind, actually. I might have nothing else on.
About 9 o'clock, I'm going to do a review of The Queen tonight.
Yeah,
and what I'm going to go see tomorrow, maybe not tomorrow, but later on this week, I'm going to see The Good Shepherd. You know of that one?
The Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
All of those. It's got an amazing cast.
Directed by De Niro.
Is it directed by De Niro?
Yeah, it's about the rise of the CIA and the intelligence agencies in the United States and how they came together.
It's got Angelina Jolie, it's got De Niro in it, it's got John Turturro.
Oh, I love John Turturro!
Yeah, he's excellent. He's really good. And it's got a couple of other actors in it. Basically, the cast was amazing.
It's Matt Damon in the lead role. Hello. You dropped out again. You dropped out again for seconds there.
I did? Okay, yeah.
It's got Matt Damon, Angelina Jolie, Alec Baldwin, Billy Crudup, De Niro, Kia Dullier, who I haven't seen since 2001, Michael Gambon, who's always good, William Hurt, Timothy Hutton, Joe Pesci, John Turturro, as you said. Great cast.
Amazing cast.
Yeah.
Amazing cast. Is it Tim Hutton is... He's great. Joe Pesci's, he's pretty good. Did you ever see a television show called Stella Street?
Yes, I did. The British guys taking off the Stones and the Mafia and Bowie and everyone.
Joe Pesci and Bowie and Keith and Mick owned the corner store.
Yeah, and Michael Caine was always in it as well. Hello, hello, lads. How's it going? Hello, lads.
Is something you don't know. Oh no, that was a really funny show.
It was a good show. I really enjoyed that when I saw it a couple of times.
I also really enjoyed that Borat film, or for what was it called? I think for the glorious Kazakhstan.
For make glorious benefit of Kazakhstan. Yes.
Kazakhstan. cultural learnings of America from a glorious bit of cancer, whatever, something like that. It's something extraordinarily funny and long and impossible to say, and people just call it Borat.
Yeah.
But it that film cost...
Nothing.
No, it cost a little bit, but not much. I think it was an $18 million film, and it's turned over in the vicinity of $250 or something. So the investment, which was... It was a news... It was a Rupert Murdoch indirectly funded venture. I can't remember the name of the company, but it's one of those big film companies.
Yeah, it was Fox.
Fox. Okay, sorry. Mm. Yeah. Rupert was at a shareholders or an analyst briefing recently, and somebody asked him, you know, Rupert, you know, Borat was an extraordinary success. You're going to make another one? And he said, oh, of course we're making... We're making another one, of course we are. And I happen to know a guy who knows Sacha Cohen, Baron Cohen, and he's got no intention of making another one at all.
Another so Borat?
No.
Yeah, the rumour was he was going to make a film based on Bruno, but I'm not sure that's been actually confirmed by him.
I gather it's happening as we speak. They're in some sort of pre-production at the moment on that.
You know his missus, do you?
No, I know a guy. I know who runs Village Roadshow in Australia. And he's Jewish, and there's the Jewish mafia vibe, you know, in movies, as you can imagine. So I'm always hitting him up for...
The Jewish mafia vibe in the movies. The entire film industry is run by Jews, man. What are you saying, that they all get together over a baklava and talk about it, or what?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's Greek baklava, is it? It's got nothing to do with Jews.
Well, no, you're right. Yeah. I don't know. It's just something, you know, maybe jewelry. They could have a usury, a pile full of, you know, usury in front of them and talk about the movies or something. I don't know.
All right, but I get the feeling you're just talking shit now. Complete talking shit. You're just making shit up as you go along. And that's why I like you, Andrew Pegler.
Thank you.
Freelance journalist to the stars.
Yep, like black holes.
So,
I like to bookend my interviews with a gag at the beginning and at the end.
Yeah, no, that's...
And I like it to make...
And the same gag.
The same gag.
The same just in case they didn't get it the first time. Yeah,
it's important, yeah.
What is it, something about a gag you have to explain something? All right, mate, that's it. Talk to you soon, buddy. Look after yourself. Cheers.
All the best. See you, Cameron.
Hi, everybody. This is Wayne Termel asking you to join me for the Working Week. Not the whole week, because neither of us has that much time, but for the Working Week podcast. That's the weekly digest of research, news, and opinion from the pages of managementissues.com. And that's the world's leading site for business, management, and human resources. My guests and I will talk about the news that matters to those of us just trying to survive the working week. That's workingweek.thepodcastnetwork.com.